Welcome, viewers and listeners, to CHP Talks. Here again with very honored to have with us today Major Russ Cooper, who's been on the show before. Russ, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, pleasure to be with you, Ron.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, Major Russ Cooper is the founder and the board chair, president, and CEO of Canadian Citizens for Charter Rights and Freedoms, C3RF. Major Cooper is retired from both the Royal Canadian Air Force and from Air Canada. In his military career, he was a decorated CF-18 combat pilot in Iraq and Kuwait, and he's also served in several staff positions as director of major capital acquisition projects. In the civilian aviation sector, he served as an international airline pilot with national responsibilities in the field of post-9/11 civil aviation security. Big one. He has published internationally in this latter area. And he is now fully retired from his follow-on career as a human factors engineer and a Transport Canada flight test pilot delegate. And he is pursuing an abiding interest in the preservation of fundamental Canadian charter rights through C3RF. This latter pursuit has been prompted by his sense that these rights, hard won by the sacrifice of Canadians past, are under attack and on the verge of being lost. Again, Major Cooper, it's a real honor to have you with us today. And we wanted to talk a little bit today about Ukraine. That has been kind of a major event going on in the world for some time now. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of thought and talk about Ukraine. I think early on, Canadians, you know, felt sorry for this country that was being, invaded by Russia and very hostile to Putin's aggression. Now, since that time, I think a lot of us have learned quite a bit more about the background. I think you expressed some concerns early on. Maybe just give us an idea of, why this has been going on for so long. I think some people expected, Russia to just roll in and take over Ukraine, and there were lots of concerns about things going on from there, developing out of that. And of course, the world, the Western world, primarily has been supportive of Ukraine with money, at least, and arms. Anyway, give us your take on what's going on there now, maybe how it started, and why Canadians should be concerned about this ongoing development there.
Well, thanks for the introduction, Rod. I really appreciate it. I guess my experience or my recollections regards Ukraine go all the way back to 1991 when I was involved in the Persian Gulf War with the CF-18 squadron there. That was a tumultuous time, and we saw before our eyes the USSR collapse before us. And basically the world changed. Its power structure, its balance of power structure changed drastically. Initially, we saw a golden opportunity to take the Soviet Union and turn it from an enemy, a belligerent enemy, into a friend. And there was, I recall, something called the Partnerships for Peace that NATO put up, and actually Hungary and Ukraine actually were the first two countries brought on board for this Partnerships of Peace program. But as well, and probably a little bit less known, was the fact that Russia was also a member of this Partnerships for Peace initiative. The whole unraveling of the Soviet Union didn't come about just by happenstance. There was a lot of discussion beforehand, and Gorbachev made it clear that if the Soviet Union was going to go that way, it needed assurances from the West that there would be no encroachment on its security. And the West did offer up those security guarantees. As a matter of fact, it's in the historical archives that the Americans, NATO, came forward and said it would not move one inch closer to Russia as it unraveled to become a federated country. So with that in mind, we have this promise in place that that there was going to be no encroachment on Russian security interests. And this is extremely important because Russia was looking at this as an existential problem. If it was going to unravel and it was going to have an enemy at its doorstep, then it would see that as an existential problem, much in the same way that it faced with Nazi Germany in 1941 when Hitler kicked off Operation Barbarossa. Operation Barbarossa was a three-pronged attack, north, central, south vectors. The south vector was directed directly through Ukraine to secure the wheat fields and then move on into the Caucasus to secure the oil. That route, that southern route, accesses the soft underbelly of Russia. So you can see where Russia had very, very large concerns about Ukraine going the way of the West or aligning itself with the West and putting Western resources and military equipment and operations on its doorstep. So with that in mind, we see the buildup to what eventually became the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022. And it basically came after many, many warnings from Russia, from Putin, to just hold off, stay back, respect our sovereignty here. And since 1991, actually the 1993, when Ukraine officially gave up its nuclear weapons and presented itself onto the world stage as a unique country, we saw this back and forth, this yin and yang of Ukraine talking to the West, wanting to go to the West, talking to the Russians, wanting to remain under its operational sphere of influence, back and forth. And NATO, during this process, has encroached on Russia. NATO started off with some 14 nations, I believe, before the fall of the Soviet Union, and now it's picked up another 13 or 14. So, and a lot of these countries are abut Russian territory. And the West and NATO started talking to Ukraine about joining NATO in 2008. Specifically, they made an entreatment. Then again in 2014, we saw the Maidan Revolution, which saw a Russian friendly prime minister being ousted for a Western friendly prime minister, followed very quickly by Russia's taking over the Crimea, which was no coincidence, and then moving on into 2021. With Biden making another specific request or specific entreaty to Ukraine to come on board to NATO. And we see the whole thing being set up where one could easily say that Russia had no choice. No. It had to move to protect its existential interests. And therefore, we saw the kickoff of their invasion of their special military operation in February 2022. But there's two sides to the story, and I'm afraid that we're not seeing both sides. We're only seeing one side of a story, and it's a very, very it's a very manipulative story that we're being told at this point in time.
Yeah, of course, our hearts are broken for the families, the individuals who have been killed and injured in this war. Yes. Hundreds of thousands, I guess. You may have a more accurate number, but even on both sides, Russian soldiers as well as Ukrainians that have been terribly, houses destroyed, families destroyed, and general upheaval.
Yes.
I think many people are surprised that it has gone on this long. It sort of, and I think that's part of, as Canadians and many Westerners often tend to cheer for the underdog. And I think in the beginning, Ukraine was seen as a, you know, a poor, helpless victim of aggression. I think there's more to it than that. But how is it that it's gone on this long? You know, why was the massive power of Russia not able to just simply overwhelm Ukraine in a short period of time?
Well, the as you say, the there are big losers in this whole thing, and it's the real loser is the Ukrainian people. They're being put through a tremendous amount of suffering as a result of this this conflagration that's going on between Ukraine and Russia. And I think when you talk about why has it gone on so long, I think we have to understand that this is not just Ukraine that is fighting for its own territorial integrity and democracy. This is the West coming in behind it, backfilling it, and basically using Ukraine as a proxy to execute its objectives in this whole balance of power tussle that is going on in the world today. So we see it going on so long. You have to give the Ukrainians credit for their fighting ability, for their pluck. There's no two ways about that. But it is the weaponry, the support through all means, intelligence, all kinds of communications type support that is being pushed into Ukraine to make this go on and on and on. And actually, it's kind of surprising to see Canada, you know, like Canada was always the peacekeeper, the peacemaker. You know, if there was one country in the world that would take a look at a conflagration and say, hey, wait a minute, can't we just sit down and have a chat about this?
Right.
It's Canada.
Yeah.
And that Canada has long gone, because it's nowhere to be seen now, as Canada is actively putting fuel on this fire by giving its support, unconditional support to the military efforts being executed by the Ukraine. So we're seeing a change Canada partake in this whole diplomatic effort regards to Ukraine and Russia.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, even the U.S. president, current president, you know, they were seen as, I think the Democrats were seen as the peace-loving people. You know, let's stay out of conflict. Whereas the bombastic Mr. Trump, who, you know, was basically, you know, challenging world dictators and whatever, they really didn't have that kind of conflict going on while Trump was in the White House. Now they've got this so-called peace-loving Democrat, and they're fueling this fire in the Ukraine. What do you think this is doing to our own military preparedness? We've been sending money and arms over there. You know, I think I've long been of the opinion that Canada has not done enough to prepare it, we haven't done enough to prepare ourselves for, you know, potential problems, and you know, this seems like we're draining our resources on this faraway conflict.
Yes, I think when you talk about the impact on Canadian military, I think it's you see it every day in the news reports. Just today, I saw where the Canadian military has got a 35% shortage when it comes to recruitment goals for this past year. 35% figures also as a number when you look at the number of troops who believe that they don't have the support and the supplies they need to carry out their job. That's a recent news story as well. In the meantime, you've got all of this this money. I think we're upwards of $8 billion now. You know, Canada has funded the Ukrainian effort both, you know, governmentally and militarily, an $8 billion package that is quite a bit of money just to throw out there. And then we have The other odd aspect of this all is that there's no there's no recounting of where this money is going. There's no one can point to a balance sheet and say this money went there to do this. That's just not there, and the media is not asking for it. There's no questions about it. So this is a really, really big problem, given the fact that Ukraine has a long, long history of corruption, and that has gone back since the days of its inception back in 1993. Okay. So we have a number of problems as far as the Canadian military goes. When I was back in the military, I retired in 1997, and we were just coming off something that General Hillier, at the time, he was the CDS, Chief of the Defense Staff, he called a decade of darkness. I think that we have descended well down into that that well, that decade of darkness, to initiate a new one. And I think the military is in dire straits and is in need of much support, and it's just not getting it.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder if you know, some of the recruitment problems may have to do with just a general sense in Canada that the country's gone off the rails. And you know,
joined the military. When I joined, I was 17 years old, and I you know, I didn't know much about anything, and I thought it was you know, it was a good way to get an education without having to pay for one. And I like the fact that there was maybe adventure down the road, you know, being in the Air Force and a pilot. It kind of intrigued me. But as I got into it in my 29-year career, I, you know, I stayed in that long because I felt I was serving a purpose, a worthwhile purpose, defending Canada, its principles, its values. You know, there was something there that that was worth fighting for. And if people look at the military and they don't have that sense of purpose, good purpose, solid purpose, then that's just going to take away tremendously from your ability to recruit those kinds of people who want to do those kinds of honorable things. So yeah, I think it is a big part.
What do you think about this Wagner group? This it was kind of a big blip on the radar screen there for a week or so. Did that surprise you that this?
It did. Perjorgan, I probably mispronounced his name. He's a very charismatic head of Wagner Group, but he is not the operational impetus behind it. Wagner Group was started by a person called Dmitry Utin. He's a former Russian special ops tutors in Chechnya, and a reputation as a ruthless and brutal operator, but an operational genius nonetheless. So Prigozhin is a bit of a high flyer in that he likes the attention. He's a social media star, and this whole move to direct troops towards Moscow through Rostov could be seen as being an overly dramatic initiative that surprised many people, because quite frankly it was doomed to fail. I mean, yeah. Wagner Group doesn't have the resources or the size or the ability to take on the whole Russian Federation. So I guess one might think that he's trying to make a point and trying to get some more support from the Russian military staffs. But that was a surprise. And now we see the Wagner Group kind of stranded in Belarus, you know, in exile type thing. And there's talk now about it being disbanded and dispersed amongst the other Russian military forces. It's still alive and has impact in places like Syria and sub-Saharan Africa, where it's conducted operations in the past and still does. No. But as far as a mercenary group that stays together in this whole Russian-Ukrainian conflict as a dedicated unit, I doubt that that's going to be the case. I don't think Putin is going to let that happen. No. So that's still up in the air.
Yeah. How does Canada get out of this quagmire? Well, you know, we all want to see this conflict come to an end. What's the honorable way out for Canada and the West? You know, nobody likes to admit that they have made a mistake. No. But there's obviously been a lot of mistakes made there, and mistakes that are costing people's lives, and it goes on and on. And how do we end this conflict? Or
well, I guess you could say the easy way out is to start calling for negotiations for peace talks. That, however, was tried back in April of 2022. The Ukrainians were ready at the time to come to the table. The Russians were ready to come to the table, talk peace. But that whole effort was thwarted by NATO and the West, the alliance.
Really?
In particular, Boris Johnson was noted as traveling personally to Ukraine, to Kiev, to tell Zelensky to forget about peace talks. We're going to support you. You know, keep going, keep fighting. So, seeing peace talks as the way forward in this is I think the best route to pursue, but I don't think there is a willingness on the part of the Western alliance to see that happen. I think the Western alliance seems to have as its goal a regime change. They've said as much. Biden has said as much, and they seem dead set on breaking Russia up into dispersed parts, that is just, when you're dealing with a nuclear power like Russia, that I can't think of a more dangerous thing to do. But that seems to be the path we're on, and it's all in the name of something. And you hear this more and more, a term called rules-based order. We are doing this for democracy, for the rules-based order. And, maybe people should start asking the question, what is a rules-based order? What does that mean? And who makes the rules?
Yeah.
Because I think what we're finding now is there are people and countries throughout the world who don't want to go along with this rules-based order because they have a feeling that they're not going to have a part to play when it comes to making the rules. And you're starting to see this this tectonic shift. This balance of power shift happening from American hegemony around the world to one that is being broken up and becoming multipolar.
Yeah.
You see, okay. BRICS nations coming forward and actually, if not supporting Russia, then abstaining from any support for the Western thrust.
Yeah, that rules-based order sounds a little too much like a new world order, which
doesn't it?
Another term that's being thrown around a lot, and like,
yes,
that really brings the question up, who makes the rules? There's lots of talk about the WEF and WHO dictating to countries who subserviently, you know, give themselves to that. I think in Canada, our country, our leadership has been really bending over backwards to allow for international dominance of our own objectives, and even provinces. I'm in British Columbia, and it seems like our province is all too ready to sign on to whatever the WHO might put forward. And of course, the WEF is socialism on a global scale.
Yes. Socialism, I don't know if I'd call that socialism, Rod. I think when you talk about the WEF, and it's a conglomeration of elites, moneyed, very powerful and moneyed personalities, non-governmental organizations, industrialists coming together. When you look at the package that is coming together under the WEF and its impending rule, you're not looking so much at socialism as I think you're looking at fascism.
Yeah,
you're looking at a standing up a kind of an alliance of entities like you saw in Mussolini's Italy.
Yeah,
back pre World War II.
Yeah, well, private public partnerships, I guess, and the Build Back Better, sloganeers.
Yes.
But even, you know, Hitler, of course, had that combination with the National Socialism. He called them National Socialist, but really it was a conglomeration also of industrialist bankers and the military, right? Which is a very dangerous combination.
Yes, I think that's closer to the truth of what we're seeing develop and ask us to jump on board with.
Yeah.
Now you mentioned what could we do? I think this whole thing will start to unravel as soon as Canadians start asking questions about the narratives that are being shoved down their throats. We have all these narratives, and they're easy to pick out. You know, these narratives are they're characterized by being shrill, repetitive, and very emotional. You know, many times they'll include ad hominem attacks. You know, if you come forward with a question, I don't think it works that way, or how do you explain this? You don't get an answer. What you get is you get an insult. You're berated, and you're canceled, and we end up with what we call cancel culture. So the best thing for Canadians to do is to start asking questions, regardless of the repercussions of being insulted. Or as when I was a kid many, many years ago, we used to have a saying, sticks and stones can mm-hmm. break my bones, but names will never hurt me.
Right.
We need to bring that back. But number one, what Canadians can do is bring back that saying and repeat it every time you get insulted by someone who's trying to cancel you.
Right. That's a good one. I remember that from just when I was very, very young.
Yeah.
And you're right. That's an enduring little phrase.
But you never hear it anymore. Hear it. And we should. We should hear it much more.
And yet name calling can be painful, you know, for the recipient, and nobody likes to be misunderstood, you know. So when people ascribe motives to us, you know, we in the Christian Heritage Party, of course, get slandered all the time by people who, you know, call us, you know, homophobes, racists, and things like that, completely with no justification.
No.
I just not got a notice this morning from one of our previous guests, Päivi Räsänen in Finland, who in August will be facing court again for basically tweeting out you know, some Bible verses, which now the far left, which is, you know, given itself the role of, you know, the
judge and prosecutor.
Yeah, exactly. And they just can't stand to have people of other views speaking them out loud. Like Justin Trudeau, you know, during the truckers thing, he said people coming with unacceptable views, which they are expressing.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, that's interesting because C3RF, Canadian Citizens for Charter Rights and Freedoms, were starting a billboard campaign. And we feature that that phrase on our billboard, unacceptable views. And we ask Canadians, does the charter forbid unacceptable views in quotation marks? I don't think the charter does, but some people are sure trying to make it sound like it does. But
yeah, well, they want to get into your brain and, you know, convince you that thinking differently than they do is there's somehow a crime in that. They want to make, well, they call it hate when you say something that they disagree with. So
yes,
but
that's the way. And you know, Canadians have just got to work through the pain associated with being insulted and ask those questions, demand explanations, and maybe vote accordingly, you know, as if they don't get the answers they feel they deserve.
Absolutely. So in a general question about the Canadian military, what are the biggest needs other than morale, you know, a redirection and a you know, purpose building, you know, kind of a redefinition of the purpose of Canada and of our military, but materially, what are the biggest needs do you see in the Canadian military?
Well, I mean, across the board, you're looking at, you know, Air Force, Army, Navy elements, all of them have huge shortfalls in equipment. The real big thing is the equipment. You know, you can always buy, you can always get, you know, sooner or later. Look at the equipment we've secured you for Ukraine. Obviously, if there is a will to bring it on board, we're going to bring it on board. Look at what happened during the Harper years. We brought in huge acquisitions with the major air transports were brought on board, new Hercules J aircraft, the new massive troop transports that we brought on board. You know, you can do it, but what you can't do is you can't you can't acquire good people and experience overnight. That's one thing that you can't do. That's got to be inculcated. It's got to be worked at. It takes decades to create a military with an ethos that will fight to win, and that's what the military needs most right now. I'd say it's leadership.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid, you know, when you talk leadership, you talk about being focused on objectives that count. And I think that our military is well down the social engineering path and has kind of left the operational perspective, the operational priorities behind. The military really needs to get back to basics.
Yeah.
And the basics of being a military and a machine that fights to win. I like to think that I was part of a machine like that when I was in my service years. But I noticed over my 29 years, it was becoming more and more difficult as the Canadian military went more and more down the social engineering path. And I'm afraid right now it's gotten to the point where it seems to me that the military is more proud of flying rainbow flags than they are flying the maple leaf.
Yeah.
And that's a big, big problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Major Russ Cooper, thank you for being with us today. What are your final comments to our listeners regarding the path forward for Canada and in general, even outside of the military? Anyway, your final comments for...
Things are changing. People should have hope. Things are changing. People are starting to wake up. It's a bit of a process, but it's occurring. And you can see it happen every day. More and more people are starting to come awake. For people who would like to join us at Canadian Citizens for Charter Rights and Freedoms, take a look at our website, canadiancitizensplural.org. Join us in the debate there. You can, help us ask questions, and because that's really what's required at this point in time.
Very good. Very good. Well, you need good questions before you can get good answers. So
that's right.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. God bless you, and continue your good work for freedom.
Thanks, Rod.